This is Backstory with us, the American History Guys. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th Century Guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, the 19th Century Guy.
And I'm Brian Bellow, 20th Century History Guy. At the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, 90 years ago this week, World War I officially came to an end with the signing of the armistice in France. The following year, Woodrow Wilson declared November 11th Armistice Day, a day to honor the veterans of the Great War.
How much our nation honored those veterans the other 364 days of the year? Well, that's debatable. One person who might tell you that it didn't do much knows whereof he speaks. His name is Frank Buckles, and at 107 years of age, he's the last surviving American veteran of World War I. Listen to what he told a Library of Congress interviewer a few years back about his homecoming after the war.
The YMCA did give me a one-month free membership. That's the only consideration I ever saw given to a soldier after the war.
A one-month free membership to the YMCA. Now, compare that to this.
It was really amazing that when I went back to school, about half of the student body was veterans.
Absolutely.
Going to school on the GI Bill.
That's Ken Bergerson, a Navy vet from the Korean War and one of the millions of veterans of his generation educated courtesy of the GI Bill.
So which of these two veterans' experience was more typical? That's the question we're asking today on our special Veterans Day edition of Backstory. How have we as a country treated returning vets over the course of our history? Are the challenges they face today the same ones that veterans faced in the past? And how much do the answers to any of these questions depend on the war? Are veterans only as popular as the wars they fought in?
We're going to start by listening to a little more of my conversation with Ken Bergerson. A few weeks ago, he invited me out to the American Legion post in Shadwell, Virginia, where he used to be commander. And he introduced me to a couple of his fellow vets.
All right, I'm Lynn Hartman. I was in the Korean conflict. I did not go overseas.
I'm Art Hortel. I enlisted in the aviation cadets in 1942. And I got my wings as a bombardier and ended up with the 8th Air Force in England.
We got to talking about the treatment of World War II vets while that war was still going on.
The people were 100% behind the veterans. Now, my brother enlisted in the Navy about two or three weeks after Pearl Harbor. He was at boot camp down in Norfolk. Now, he said he was there early enough to see signs around Norfolk at restaurants saying no dogs or sailors allowed in here. But that attitude certainly did not last very long. When the shooting started, the people were right behind us.
Those good vibes, they didn't go away. Lynn Hartman, the Korea-era vet who did not go overseas, even got a little choked up when he talked about the gratitude perfect strangers sometimes show him, even now.
It does me a lot of good to go have my hat on and go into the store and somebody shake your hand. Thank you for what you did for your country.
That embarrasses me when someone says that. I feel like, you know, I didn't do anything. I was just doing what everyone else did there. The people that stayed at home and built the bombers and the jeeps and everything. It was just about a 99.9% effort by the American people.
Towards the end of our interview, I asked them how veterans of the current war would answer my questions.
I don't think they would think any different than us. They're doing the same thing that we did. You know, they're doing their duty and just, you know, praying that they can come home alive.
I don't think our people are opposed to them as they were in Vietnam. I think we're ignoring them. I mean, if you don't have a member of your family there, I think the way we live, we just don't think about it. We're all mad that we're in a war, but it's not as personal to us as it was in World War II.
If you want to think about wars that were personal, nothing like the American Civil War. Took place right here on our own land, involved virtually everybody, killed massive numbers of people over issues of fundamental difference, and people simply could not put it out of their minds for generations. So decade after decade, people carried the grudge on both sides against their countrymen on the other side. I want to play for you guys an interview I did recently with a man who continues to live with this struggle. He served for more than 20 years in the U.S. Navy during Vietnam and the first Persian Gulf War, but he continues to identify very strongly with a very different group of veterans.
I am Frank Ernest, representing the Virginia Division, Sons of Confederate Veterans. I am the immediate past commander of the Virginia Division and currently serving as International Chief of Heritage Defense.
Perhaps you could give us a brief overview of the history of the organization.
Well, with the American Legion and the Veterans of Foreign Wars and other organizations, to put it simply, the Korean veterans take care of the older World War II vets. The Vietnam vets take care of the Korean vets as they get older. That was not going to happen with the Confederate veterans because there would never be any more Confederate veterans generated. So in 1896, the veterans said, well, who will take care of us as we get older? And they formed the organization I'm currently associated with, the Sons of Confederate Veterans, which actually started out with the genuine Sons of the Veterans.
And what's your personal connection?
Great-great-grandfather who rode with the 9th Virginia Cavalry, a great-great-uncle rode with Stuart in the 1st Virginia Cavalry. I came in under a great-great-uncle who served with General Pickett in the 18th Virginia Infantry.
It sounds like you have your bona fides lined up there.
Right. If you find out you have a Confederate ancestor, I guarantee you have at least a dozen.
So let me ask you this, and literally something I've never understood, is how you are a veteran of the United States Navy, I understand, 20 years, correct?
Yes, sir.
Really understood how somebody could be loyal to the United States and loyal to a nation that tried to leave the United States. Perhaps you can explain that to me. I've never understood how people have a Confederate flag and an American flag on their car, since the whole point of the Confederacy was to leave the United States.
We thought it was a pretty good idea in 1776 when we left England, and that turned out to be a good idea. Our ancestors,
but you don't see Union Jacks on our cars, though.
Well, that's because we're the side that separated from England, but you do see Union Jacks in Williamsburg, and you don't see anybody get upset about that fact because they're celebrating the history of what happened. The Confederate flag, we're the only section of the country that has a regional flag. I can go anywhere as a Virginian in the South, and when I see that flag, it simply ties me to my brothers in Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama. I know that my ancestors, like theirs, fought alongside each other to stand up for American freedoms and rights as expressed in the Constitution of the United States of America.
What do you say, though, to black people about that?
Again, with these misconceptions about it, I say read and study and find out the truth. Not only did conscripted slaves fight on both sides because they were conscripted.
No, sir. This is not true. And we won't argue about this on the air, but we can't go down this road of all these black people fighting for the Confederacy.
No black people ever fought for the Confederacy?
Any numbers of those are trivial compared to the 4 million people held in slavery for 200 years and the 180,000 who fought for the Union, okay? So it's a trivial thing. So I'm going to just ask the question again.
That's fine. Okay. But I'm not here to defend slavery.
I'm not trying to put you in a corner on that, okay?
Yes,
I'm just going to ask you the question again and ask, what do you say to black people when they see the Confederate flag and they think it means something else?
Well, the Confederate flag has been misused. We don't deny that. We can also show you films that exist of 40,000 Klansmen marching down Pennsylvania Avenue with the U.S. flag. So that's certainly been misused. We don't approve of these radical racist organizations using our emblem, mm-hmm. which we consider a sacred emblem. The flag, as used historically by the Confederate States of America, was a grouping of people fighting for a number of reasons and for their rights as they saw them under the Constitution of America. And it's not against anybody, black, white, or otherwise.
What do you think that the heritage of the Confederacy has to tell us about the situation of veterans today coming back from the war in Iraq?
Well, as Sons of Confederate Veterans, our job is to honor the veterans, just like any other veterans organization. A lot of that comes down to as simply as taking care of monuments and marking graves. And as I've told city councils, you're marking an American soldier's grave. We're not getting into what he did or didn't fight for, or what his government did or didn't believe. They are veterans. We're talking about veterans today. These are American veterans who, like any other American in any other war from the Revolutionary War on, believe strongly enough to fight and die for their beliefs, and we feel that they should be honored. As a matter of fact, I'm really happy to see, as a Vietnam-era veteran, that although there are quite a few people not satisfied with the war we're currently in and how it's being conducted, at least they're not taking it out on the troops like they did in Vietnam.
And it does seem that, certainly compared to Vietnam, that people, whatever their thoughts about the war, do have a different attitude about the veterans and where blame lies if there's blame to be assigned.
Yes, yes.
I appreciate you giving us this time for the interview, and thanks very much.
Thank you, sir.
Frank Ernest is Chief of Heritage Defense for the Sons of Confederate Veterans.
Well, Ed, that was an interesting interview, and I would wonder, as a son of the North, how you do feel about this invocation of heritage to justify honoring people who made war against their country.
Well, you know, I've looked at this for decades now and spoken to SCV groups, and I find that they want to talk about the constitutionality of secession, and it strikes me that there is some truth to what they say about that. It was not clear in the Constitution itself that states could not leave.
Oh, I would say that's right.
Right? Yeah. So, mm-hmm. You know, I guess what struck me most in our interview here was the way that he framed this in terms of veterans, mm-hmm. that putting one's life at risk is really what is honored. And they say that the cause is not really salient because the cause is defined by the politicians. The cause is defined by the state.
Right. But I think one of the things we're celebrating when we celebrate Confederates is their patriotism. That is, they're saying it wasn't that we were just cannon fodder and we had no choice and you got to respect our existential dilemma. No, they're saying we need respect because we made the choice to defend our country.
They're trying to have it both ways.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
And that's the reason it goes back to the very first thing I said. What do they think that they are fighting for then? It's the very same values that are inscribed in the American Constitution. So there's a lot of sophistry involved in all of this, I think it's fair to say. And it would be better if we had some quick language to excise all this, but apparently we can't find it because we keep going over and over and over this ground and not being able to persuade each other of even what we're talking about.
We're talking today about war veterans in American history. Some of you have already sent in your questions and comments on the topic, and we've invited you to join us on the phone.
First up, we have Curtis calling in from Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Curtis, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm just wondering if there's evidence out there that shows that when black veterans returned from World War One or Two, that they became more civic-minded and or politically active.
Yeah, Curtis, that's a great question. You're asking, did African Americans get more involved, more engaged when they came back from war?
Right.
And the answer is an emphatic yes. Now, you probably know that during World War II, blacks finally were allowed to fight, and especially that active duty service in the military certainly encouraged blacks to feel great things would happen after the war. And in fact, a lot of historians feel that the very origins of the modern civil rights movement came out of rising expectations on the part of African Americans for what they might realize when they returned home.
But Brian, your answer to Curtis's question is really interesting to me because World War II seems to be a lot different from World War I. And maybe you could talk about why it was that World War I did not create the kind of mobilization that could lead to lasting social and political change for African Americans.
Yeah, I'm going to bounce that to Ed because it's a Southern kind of thing, I think.
Well, I feel a lot of pressure here, but I think that your point's correct. It's not that the language of aspiration and of pride and responsibility was absent. W.B. Du Bois reluctantly supported World War I precisely because he thought it would have the kind of consequence that World War II ultimately had.
So what happened? What went wrong?
Well, several things went wrong.
It's first called of all, American history.
Well,
I'm going to have to learn something about that one day.
Well, several things. Black soldiers and sailors were not given the opportunity to be on the front lines in World War I the same way they were in World War II, very intentionally, because white Southerners in particular also agreed that the war could be a turning point in Black Americans' lives and sought to prevent it. And they segregated the camps, they segregated the units, and tried, certainly in the South, to downplay the actual accomplishments of Black Americans. The other thing that happened, of course, is that when the war ended, World War I, a giant backlash against all kinds of expectations. So there was anti-labor acts, anti-immigrant acts. So there's a great way of trying to contain the social consequences of World War I, and I think partly containing the aspirations of Black Americans was one part of that. So lots of different parts,
and,
too.
And Curtis, I'm going to add one more layer here, which is a factor that really put the African-American effort over the top after World War II, not that anything happened quickly, as you know. A factor that was crucial was the nature of the enemy we were fighting, Adolf Hitler. So that all Americans, including Southerners, were faced with this great paradox after World War II. Well, wait a second. If racialist ideologies enforced by the state are what we just fought and died for, white and black, what do we make of these Jim Crow laws in the South? So the nature of the enemy is really important here, too.
Well, I'm just wondering, because we know that Jim Crow didn't topple in 1945 after the armistice was signed. How were they able to reconcile this struggle to save the world for democracy and this insistence that blacks stay in their place?
Well, ironically, white Southerners laid claim to the threat of another war as one more reason to delay the fulfillment of black freedom, which was the Cold War. And, of course, what they would say is, well, yeah, I see your point, but we have much bigger problems right now than your freedom. We've got to stick together and not rock the boat to fight the Russians and the Chinese. You know, you think about back in the Civil Rights Movement, the most effective charge that white Southerners would make, at least to each other, and they certainly tried it to the rest of the country, was these are commies who are coming in, outside agitators who are disrupting America, who, if you remember, just saved the world and is going to have to save it again. So it's ironic that they used communism to say that we simply can't fulfill what we began in World War II.
Curtis, great call. Hope to hear from you again.
Okay, thank you so much for the excellent answers.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Once we got out there in the Pacific, we landed at Espirito Santo's. We joined the Marines there, and we fought with them. We handled the ammo and everything.
That's Bobby Wallace, a Navy veteran of World War II. In this interview from a few years back, he said that even though blacks were allowed to fight alongside whites, prejudice was alive and well in the military, and his fellow sailors didn't mince words.
You're black SOB, and you this and you the other, and we're going to see that you don't go home and all this. But some of those same men, when they got hit, and a lot of the black sailors or black Marines responded to their needs, those same men looked up with a, not shock, but a surprise maybe, that some of the men that they had called names and looked down on, they were the very ones that put bandages on their wounds, calmed them down when they was out of it. They done told us we wasn't gonna never amount to nothing. So we had to prove that we were who we said we were. So that's what made me the man that I am today. No doubt if I hadn't went through the prejudice and hatred of World War II, I wouldn't be here today. But because I went through those things, a few things I run into now, piece of cake. Can I get a swig of this coffee?
That's World War II veteran Bobby Wallace speaking to a Library of Congress interviewer in 2002. Wallace died earlier this year. We'll link to the entire interview on our website, backstoryradio.org. We're going to take another call now. It's Mary in Phoenix, Arizona. Mary, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you. I have a question about World War II veterans. I conducted oral histories with about a dozen of these veterans, mm-hmm. and I found that a lot of the white veterans, the men, took advantage of the GI Bill, but it was very common for the women to not use that GI Bill. And also, it seemed like a lot of the minority men did not use it. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, Mary, there's no question that white men took advantage of the GI Bill disproportionately, even allowing for adjustments as to how many women, for instance, were even eligible for it. And the main reason for this is that, like a lot of things in our country, the GI Bill operated indirectly. So let's take a benefit like the subsidized mortgages under GI. Well, if you were African-American and you had served loyally, you probably would have had a lot of trouble getting a bank to give you that same GI loan. You would have had trouble because of the segregated neighborhood that you lived in, and you would have had trouble just for larger reasons of discrimination. Or let's take another major GI benefit. Let's take the education benefits. A lot of schools did not admit African-Americans. A lot of African-Americans didn't have enough high school education to even qualify to go to college. Now, I've always wondered, I think 3% of the beneficiaries under the GI Bill were women. And I've actually always wanted to know more about those women veterans. So I wonder if you could tell us something about the women vets that you interviewed.
Well, they were in different branches of the service. There were WACs and WAVES, and I interviewed a WASP, but she wasn't in the service because they were excluded.
Yeah, Mary, I have a really simplistic question. Now, I married a WASP, but I don't think that's what you're talking about. What's a WAC and a WAVE and a WASP?
You've heard of the WASP, haven't you? They were women Air Force service pilots.
And WACs were?
In the Army.
Uh-huh.
And WAVES were in the Navy.
So that all makes sense.
But it seemed like the women did not go to college afterwards because they married quickly, or even during the war.
Right.
And then they started having babies.
Right, right.
But the WAVE that I interviewed did go to college. She'd always wanted to, so she used that GI Bill to do that, even though she did get married.
Right. So in the case of the women you interviewed, it was not overt discrimination, and I say overt, but it was more societal pressure about what women were expected to do.
Yes, yeah. But I like what you're saying about the minority men, because restrictive covenants were in place here in Phoenix, too, and in Arizona.
Sure.
So, of course, that would have, you know, limited where they could buy. And plus, probably a lot of them just thought they had to work. And they didn't have a family history of going to college.
You know, and this has really huge consequences for the kind of society that emerges after World War II, because that package of benefits launched a lot of lower middle class people into the middle class. And it disproportionately served white veterans and a lot of African Americans, as you point out, a lot of women who might have been launched more independently were not. How did you get involved in this project?
I worked at the Arizona Historical Society Museum in Tempe, and we did an exhibit on World War II.
Well, it's really, really cool idea.
Yeah, it was fun. It was really interesting to meet all these people.
Did all of them consider that World War II to be the good war?
The good war. Oh, my word. They considered it to be life-changing. I mean, it was probably the most important event in their life, or one of the most important. I didn't hear them call it the good war because it was hard.
Sure.
But it was a way for them to get away from their little towns, out of, you know, away from their families and their parents, and just see different parts of the world. And it was just a real change for women's roles to be involved in that war.
Well, thanks very much, Mary. We're glad to hear about your veterans in Phoenix, Arizona.
Thank you, Mary.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So Mary brought up the struggles faced by women service members in World War II. These days, of course, there are a lot more women in uniform. But in all of America's wars, it's probably fair to say that women's biggest role has been on the home front.
There's a historian named Rebecca Jo Plant at the University of San Diego, and she spent a lot of time looking at the ways that role shifted between the two world wars. She says it was a big change, and one that left a lot of war wives feeling downright confused, especially those whose husbands came home with psychological wounds. Take, for example, this letter written by the wife of a traumatized war vet in 1947.
As one of the millions of war wives, I am repeatedly told that my husband has just been through a terrible ordeal, that he is nervous and confused, and that it will take time and infinite patience and understanding from me to help him return to normal. Then again, I am told as a wife and a mother that our servicemen suffered from a new disease called momism, and it is up to we mothers to teach our children to be independent, to help them stand on their own feet and think for themselves. These two attitudes contradict one another.
So on the one hand, this woman feels like she's just supposed to be patient. On the other hand, she's worried about this new disease that's called momism. What was momism? Well, the idea was that overbearing mothers could be blamed for everything that was ailing America, including what was then being referred to as combat fatigue. The term momism had been coined 5 years earlier in a bestseller by novelist Philip Wiley. Plant says he was lashing out against a certain kind of mother, conservative, frumpy, disapproving, school marmy. You get the idea.
The argument that Wiley made was that these mothers were overly possessive with their sons, and sons in particular were the heart of the concern here, and that they tried to dominate them in the guise of mother love and sentimentality. So they overprotected them, they coddled them, they effeminized them. And he's saying, we've created this nation that is not manly enough and that lacks the fortitude to stand up to the threat of fascism.
Let me stop the tape here and point out that moms weren't always seen as a threat to democracy. During the First World War, being a mama's boy was just about the most patriotic thing you could be. Soldiers overseas didn't yearn after pinup girls. They pinned up mom.
I think that it's best to understand this just by looking at, you know, the way that boys were raised in the 19th century versus the 20th century. In the 19th century, the notion of how you make a moral man mm-hmm. was very much that you internalize the maternal figure, that the boy needs to basically have his mother's voice as his conscience. And for all kinds of complex reasons, that's changing in the 20th century, where people, their sense of how they operate as individuals is becoming much more focused on autonomy and strict ego boundaries and defining oneself really in opposition to family members rather than almost as extensions of family members.
So what did this new 20th century version of manhood mean for all those traumatized war vets trying to readjust to civilian life? Well, it wasn't entirely clear.
You have all this anxiety about mothers and how mothers might encourage sons, returning sons, to enter this regressive state in which they come back and they expect that society should just provide them with all of these benefits without actually becoming hardworking, contributing citizens themselves.
And leading to that age-old phrase, what's a mother to do?
Get out of the way was the answer that a lot of these experts said at the time. So it was the girlfriend and the wife who really bore a lot of the pressure to, you know, reintroduce men, re-civilize them, and make them functioning members of society.
So if moms were the problem, wives were the solution?
Yes. Basically, that's right.
So, Rebecca, today, the neuropsychological illness that comes from war and other situations is called post-traumatic stress disorder. I'd be really curious to know, where are moms and where are girlfriends in the causes and the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, I think they're, as always, bearing a very heavy burden because it often falls to mothers and to girlfriends to absorb a lot of the emotional trauma that initiates on the battlefield. I would say, though, that in the past, when people thought about an injured veteran or certainly a deceased veteran, their thoughts immediately went to the mother, the maternal figure, the Gold Star mother, who was seen as and assumed to have suffered the greatest loss, mm-hmm. even if the soldier was married. Mm-hmm. And now I don't think that's as true. I think that their thoughts go first to the wife and the children. You know, there's much more of an emphasis now on Gold Star families mm-hmm. and not simply the Gold Star mother per se as the person who, in a sense, has given up something she created. You know, motherhood was thought of in very civic terms. So she showed her citizenship by rearing a citizen, by mm-hmm. rearing a citizen soldier that she then sacrificed.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Rebecca Jo Plant teaches history at the University of California, San Diego. She's the author of the forthcoming book, The Repeal of Mother Love in Modern America.
Oh, mother, dear, a little fear is gleaming in your eyes. Your lips are all a-tremble as you hear me say goodbye.
It's time for another short break. When we get back, we'll look at PTSD in the age before the concept of psychology even existed.
More backstory coming up in a minute.